the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: لا غنى كالعقل، ولا فقر كالجهل، ولا ميراث كالأدب، ولا ظهير كالمشاورة.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "There is no wealth like wisdom, no destitution like ignorance, no inheritance like refinement, and no support like consultation."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept about being a student. It's really interesting. Many of us, if not all of us, have gone through school in one form or another, and we are all considered students. Some of us after high school or after college or university, perhaps a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, or even a doctorate degree, we then stop studying or we don't consider ourselves to be students anymore. But we learn a very interesting thing from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and that is the importance of being a student and the importance of being a student throughout our life. And not a student of, for example, the physical or chemical or biological sciences of the world, which in it of itself is nothing wrong, but to be a student of the Islamic sciences throughout our life. Now, as is evident and has been proved clearly for any and all unbiased, unprejudiced researcher, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, was superior to all human beings, and his knowledge was above all human beings as well. Now, naturally, such an intelligent individual, smart individual, knowledgeable individual, wise individual, such as the Holy Prophet Muhammad, was deserving of an excellent student who would be at the level where he could acquire all of this knowledge from the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so this is who Imam Ali alayhi salam was. As all of history has proved and has shown evidence, Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most intelligent, the most smart student who had accompanied a perfect man the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and this student was hungry for knowledge on the one hand, and on the other hand, this student, Imam Ali, his interest in learning from childhood till the end of his life is what made Imam Ali a student, a disciple of the highest capacity, who was walking on a path leading to the zenith, the peak, the summit of perfection. And so, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends out there who are listening, remember that we should always be the students of Islam, and we should be the best students of Islam, just as Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us, and he has shown us that to be the best student of Islam is truly a proud achievement, a profound lesson from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. After the events of Saqifa, when Abu Sufyan came to Ali, he said, "I know it's your right." So even Abu Sufyan knew about it. There was nothing implicit. It was very, very explicit. If he knew, everybody else knew about it. And he says, "You know, if you agree, I can fill the streets of Medina with horsemen and fighters for your cause." It was his right. But he said, "No, I don't want your support," because he knew that this person is a munafiq. He has his own motivations. He wanted to take advantage of the situation for his own, motives. And so he refused. So the issue is not that you might have a right goal and then you can reach to it by any means that you want. No. The goal has to be legit, and even the means to that goal has to be legitimate. This is as far as Namla is concerned. Ali is not willing to compromise even when it comes to a small ant. And then he says to Ash'as bin Qais, "Inna dunyakum indi la ahwanu min waraqatin fi fami jaradatin taqdamuha." He says to, Ash'as bin Qais, he says, "To me, your dunya is less than value compared to the leaf which is in the mouth of a locust. It's not worth. And I'm not going to, compromise my principles because of your own wrong motives." When it comes to even human beings, Amir al-Mu'mineen doesn't distinguish between Muslim and non-Muslim when it comes to justice and fairness. And this is something very clear in the Quran. How far we have moved away as a Muslim ummah from those teachings and values, it's really surprising. How can Muslims call themselves Muslims when we have just this kind of teachings and values in the Quran, in the Sunnah of the Prophet, the Seerah of the Prophet, and the example of Amir al-Mu'mineen? When he sent Malik Ashtar to Egypt, it's interesting that, Egypt at that time was a multi-faith community. There were Christians as well as Muslims under Muslim rule. And look at the epistle or the document that Ali wrote about governance and gave to Malik Ashtar. Unfortunately, Malik Ashtar was not able to reach there. People of Muawiyah killed him in the way. But if you look at that document which has survived, where he says to Malik Ashtar, وَعَشْعِرْ قَلْبَكَ الرَّحْمَ لِلْرَعِيَّةِ وَالْمُحَبَّ لَهُمْ وَاللُّطْفُ بِهِمْ. He says, Ash'ir means, you know, what we call تحت الشعور. Imbibe, make it a second nature in your heart to have mercy for your subjects and love for them and to be kind to them. وَلَا تَكُونَنَّ عَلَيْهِمْ صَبُعًا ضَارِعًا تَخْتَنِمُ أَكْلُهُمْ. Do not be like that animal which is waiting in ambush for its, you know, target to go and eat it whenever the opportunity is there. Why? Why have rahmah and muhabba and lutf to your subjects? فَإِنَّهُ صِنْفَانِ إِنَّهُمْ صِنْفَانِ. Because they are of two kinds only. إِمَّا أَخٌ لَكَ فِي الدِّينِ. Either they are your brother and in faith, or نَظِيرٌ لَكَ فِي الْخَلْقِ, or they are like you in humanity, in appearance. When you look at that statement, and this is when we say Ali is a universal personality, not bound by time and space, look at the situation in Egypt now. Look at the strife among the Muslims themselves. Look at the tension between, especially the extremist Salafis, and the Coptic Christians were a minority there. Ali, centuries ago, wrote to Malik Ashtar that there is a non-Muslim minority there. Remember, have sense of rahmah and muhabba and lutf towards all of them, whether they are in brethren in faith or like you in humanity. Centuries have passed, but even now, the churches of Coptic Christians in Egypt are being burned. For what? Which law in the Sharia allows Muslims to do that? Look at the Salafis, how they have treated the Shia minority there, which is even a smaller minority than the Coptic Christians there. The way they incite people against the Shias, the way they use the labels against the Shias, the Salafis.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight. There are reports that the Zionist regime's cabinet members have recently gathered to initiate a new wave of demolitions against Palestinian homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote in this regard, key Israeli regime cabinet members have gathered to initiate a new wave of demolitions against Palestinians' homes in Area C after a dispute erupted over the rare expulsion of illegal Jewish settlers from a new outpost in the occupied West Bank, the New Arab reported. Far-right ministers reportedly agreed to forcibly halt all new Palestinian building projects in Area C, which accounts for 60% of all land in the West Bank, before they reach completion, according to Israeli media. All major Palestinian cities in the West Bank, including Ramallah, Nablus, Al-Khalil, Beit Lahm, and Jericho, are surrounded by land designated as Area C, seen as essential to any future Palestinian state. According to Israel Hayom, this new phase of land disposition has received the blessing of the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after a dispute between Likud War Minister Yoav Gallant and far-right Bezalel Smotrich, who also holds a ministerial post in the War Ministry. The disagreement came after the Zionist regime army took the rare decision to evict a number of Jewish settlers from an unauthorized outpost in the occupied West Bank erected hours earlier. The move provoked the anger of pro-settler activists and members of Netanyahu's far-right cabinet, including Smotrich, who himself lives in a settlement in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu issued a statement saying, "The government supports settlements, but only when they are done legally and in prior coordination with the prime minister and security officials, which did not happen in this case." Smotrich had tried to order the army to cancel the demolition of the Wildcat settlement. Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, also living in a settlement, attacked the decision in the Knesset, alleging that the Zionist regime army demolishes more Jewish settlements than it does Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported that the Zionist regime occupation authorities demolished an agricultural room in East Al-Quds neighborhood of Isavia. According to a local activist, Muhammad Abu Humus said the Zionist regime police accompanying a bulldozer barged into cultivated land isolated by a section of the Zionist regime's apartheid wall in the eastern part of the neighborhood, where the heavy machinery knocked down an agricultural structure. He added that police seized olive and citrus saplings in addition to a water tank. Wafa News Agency also said there are reports that the Zionist regime army has recently admitted its forces have recently killed a Palestinian who posed no imminent danger. The army confirmed that 45-year-old father of four, Ahmad Hassan Kale, was unnecessarily shot dead in front of his son, in front of his 20-year-old son, Qusay, outside Silva town, northeast of the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, on the morning of Sunday, January 15th. Kahle was one of the dozens of Palestinian commuters stuck in traffic during morning rush hour caused by an army checkpoint erected at the town entrance. He was shot point blank with a single bullet in the neck during a physical scuffle with the Zionist regime troops after the latter forced him and his son to exit their car. Qusay said that he and his father were on the way to work when the troops topped their vehicle shortly after a sound bomb was fired at the car. According to him, it was then when the Zionist troops pepper sprayed the Palestinian father of four and forced him to get out of the car before he fainted. The Zionist media claimed in their initial reports at the time of the shooting that Kahle was shot while allegedly attempting to carry out a stabbing attack. However, following a viral video footage from the scene, the Zionist media edited their article to quote Israeli regime army sources as saying the Zionist troops opened fire after trying to arrest Kahle and that he additionally tried to snatch one of their guns.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, women's legal right on husband in the Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the women's legal rights on the husband in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, it is necessary upon the man or the husband to pay the dowry to the wife. And it has been necessary because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made this money for the wife that after the marriage, if she wants to spend it, in any place where she wants to buy anything, or she wants to enjoy the money that she has got after the marriage, she could do that, and she should not be waiting for the husband to maybe pay something to her. Therefore, Allah has made this necessity upon the man to give or pay the dowry to the wife after the marriage. Another responsibility or the right of the woman is that it is necessary for the man to provide the security in the family. He must provide the security. The family must be secure. The place where they're living must be secure. So she feels secure when she's living with her husband. She must feel secure at the place where she's living. As per the wealth or the money, as per the life, She must feel secure. She must not feel insecure in financial terms. She must not feel insecure in the terms of life, or she must not feel that she is in the danger. Therefore, it is necessary upon the husband to provide the security to the wife so that she can have a peaceful life living with him, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the woman's legal right on the husband in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, one of the other rights of the woman is that the man or the husband must not lack of zeal. He must not lack of zeal. He must take care of his wife. He must not allow his wife to be in a place where everyone can see. Unfortunately, when I talk about the Western culture, the non-Islamic culture, today we see that the man likes his wife to basically put on makeup, put on the unethical clothes and go out. And he show off his wife to the people that, look how beautiful wife do I have, or the girlfriend, for example, like if we're talking about the non-Islamic culture. This is forbidden in Islam. The wife and the husband, they must adorn themselves for each other. The wife must adorn herself for the husband. Therefore, this lack of zeal will result in the corruption. You know, other people who are looking at someone's wife, who are looking at someone's, honor, at someone's zeal. So it is not permissible in Islam. Therefore, Islam says that the man must provide a secure place to the woman, and the man should show him being the man of the house. He should protect his wife from the sights of the people, from the gaze of the people, from the talks of the people, from any kind of insecurity in which she's uncomfortable, or where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that this will bring disrespect for you. So if woman is in hijab, she's observing hijab, she's observing veil, that is a dignity or the respect for the woman herself. And it brings that dignity and respect for the husband as well. So therefore, it is necessary for the husband to secure his family from such consequences, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has recently stated that gas prices have largely stabilized, but still remain well above the long-term average. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, lingering problems in the EU energy sector can no longer be attributed to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Josep Borrell, said in an interview with the Spanish newspaper El Diario, published recently. According to the diplomat, the bloc has managed to overcome its energy dependence on Russia. He stated, "We have, in a few months, abolished the energy dependence on Russia that we had been building up for years. We went through an extremely tense phase of rising prices, but they're back to pre-conflict levels." According to Borrell, the sharp peak, which energy prices reached in August last year, was largely caused by speculative tension in the markets. The tensions in the energy market can no longer be attributed to the war. It is a structural problem of the energy sector, and in particular, of the correlation between gas prices and electricity prices, he stated. European gas prices spiked last year to a historic high of 345 euros per megawatt hour on concerns over Russian gas flows, which used to make up nearly half of Europe's supply, but started to dwindle due to Ukraine-related sanctions and technical setbacks. This week, gas futures for February delivery at TTF Hub in the Netherlands were trading in the range of 60 to 70 euros per MWH, around the values registered prior to the start of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. But the futures were still much more expensive than the 10 to 25 euros per MWH range within which they were trading in 2017 to 2019 period. Market analysts say relatively low energy prices in the region are temporary, due to mild weather and unusually high storage levels, with capacity filled to just under 82%. Many also warn that the situation is likely to worsen in the coming months, when Europe will have to refill storage in preparation for the next heating season, with next to no Russian supplies and no viable alternative suppliers. Meanwhile, Tehran Times wrote in this regard, cracks has appeared among EU alliance regarding the crisis in Eastern Europe. Germany's refusal to transfer its advanced Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine has been met with criticism by NATO members. Nearly a year into the Russia-Ukraine conflict, public divisions have appeared among the West over the support for Ukraine. The Ukrainian military has said it needs a few hundred of Western-made battle tanks. Berlin is under heavy pressure by the U.S. establishment to authorize the delivery of its most advanced tanks to Kiev. This is while Washington itself has refused to announce the delivery of its own U.S. Abrams tanks. German government officials have linked their country's own decision to send Leopard tanks, with Washington taking the lead first. In essence, Berlin has indicated it is waiting for Washington to make the first move. Germany's new defense minister Boris Pistorius says no decision had yet been made by his government. Pistorius argued there are good reasons for the delivery and there are good reasons against it. All the pros and cons have to be weighed very carefully, and that assessment is explicitly shared by many allies. Germany has also dismissed requests by its NATO allies, who have thousands of German-made tanks, to send them to the war zone. Poland, which does have the Leopard 2 tanks in its possession, has suggested it might send them to Ukraine without seeking Berlin's approval. But analysts say this would complicate future military cooperation between the two sides. Ukraine has been calling on NATO and the European Union to supply it with more advanced weapons, despite Russia's warning that this would prolong the war, the suffering of Ukrainians, as well as representing a significantly new escalation. Moscow has also warned NATO that any shipments of advanced weapons will be viewed as a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO members. Berlin has so far dispatched military assistance to Kiev, but the delivery of these tanks would represent a new escalation that Russia has been warning about. If Germany sends its tanks first and nobody else does, this may be viewed by the Kremlin that Berlin is at war with Russia. It would also make Germany appear as a warmonger in this conflict. This is something that the German government wants to avoid, especially amid Russian warnings of an escalation if the battle tanks are dispatched. Vyacheslav Volodin, speaker of Duma, Russia's lower house of parliament, warned that the US and NATO support for Ukraine is leading the world to a terrible war. He added that arguments that the nuclear powers have not previously used weapons of mass destruction in local conflicts are untenable, because these states did not face a situation where there was a threat to the security of their citizens and the territorial integrity of the country. Ukrainian troops are already being trained on German soil, not by the German military advisors themselves, but rather by the US forces that are stationed in the country. This is while the German public has already been among the worst hit as a consequence of the war. The taps of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline that used to run directly from Russia to Germany before the war have already been mostly switched off as a result of Western sanctions on Moscow. The German government also does not want to send its tanks because of fears that the Kremlin will respond with further measures by cutting off future supplies of gas and oil. Before the conflict, Germany was heavily dependent on Russian gas following decades of cooperation between the two sides. Europe as a whole relied on Moscow for 40% of its gas needs. The ensuing fighting has seen an energy crisis in Europe that has spearheaded record inflation rates not seen in several decades. Christian Molling, the deputy director at the German Council on Foreign Relations, told news media outlets that carriers have been built on the narrative that Germany is a peace-loving nation. The public mood is shifting and possibly at a tipping point. But it would be very hard to be the leader that drove to make Germany a leading player in European security. Surveys suggest that the German public support for Ukraine is less than in other Western countries. Polls also indicate that Germans are split on the question of sending the German-made battle tanks to the war zone. Since the Second World War, Germany has tried to portray itself as having a position of not taking sides in any wars, but that clearly ended in February last year when the Russia-Ukraine crisis started. Critics say the German supply of chemical weapons to the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to use it in his war against Iran is another case in this point.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. Praise God, wise, learned, intelligent, educated women like yourselves exist everywhere. And this group that is sitting here today is a sample of the population. You are a flower from a great floral garden. Praise God, we have a large number of discerning, judicious, educated, well-informed women all throughout the country. Thank God. That dream that we had about these young, pious girls growing up and becoming female scholars and scientists, praise God, that dream has been fulfilled. One of the important things that you need to do is the following. Expose the dreadful view of the Western culture toward the issue of gender and the issue of women. Tell everyone. Some people are unaware of it. There are some inside our country who do not know about it, and there are many outside the country who are unaware of it. They do not know about it in Islamic countries. Islamic countries have a thirst for learning about these kinds of things. The places which I have been to and where we are here, news of this has reached me that it is like this there. And tell the people in Western countries too.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today it is very easy to communicate using social media. You can communicate using the social media and lay the groundwork for them to pay attention to these matters. Discuss these concepts using short, expressive statements. Make statements that are both short and expressive, and then send them to increase awareness among general public. Use hashtags and things of that sort that exist. This is a great tool that is currently at your disposal. So this was one issue. The theoretical and practical view of Islam on the issue of men and women and the issue of gender. Another point with regard to the issue of women's affairs is the subject of family, which fortunately was brought up and discussed from several perspectives in these women's speeches today. It was very good. I really enjoyed their statements. You see, the formation of a family is the result of a general law in the universe, the general law of creation. That law is the law of pair, that is marriage.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all. things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional €500 million military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic, and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States suffered its worst mass shooting in nearly a year when a gunman killed 10 and wounded 10 others in California. In the nation's third largest city of Chicago, at least 30 people were shot and 7 killed over the weekend, illustrating how routine gun violence has become across the country. The California gunman showed symptoms of paranoia and mental illness, but for the last 40 years, liberal economic measures have gutted not only health services, but sent jobs overseas, eliminated anti-poverty measures, and fostered a climate of perpetual instability and insecurity.
People feel like it is every person for themselves. And for some people, then the answer to that is going to be, yeah, it's worth the risk. It's worth the, you know, it's worth taking the steps to engage in, you know, I don't know, theft, carjackings, breaking into homes, you know, and ultimately, you know, you're going to have certain situations with that that will create, you know, instances of gun violence and murder.
Last year saw almost double the number of mass shootings compared with just 4 years ago. In 2022, death rates from firearms reached their highest level in 3 decades. For many big city mayors, even Democratic ones, more cops is the answer. However, anti-police sentiment has exploded, most recently at a protest in Atlanta against yet another killing by police, and many say more militarism just isn't the solution.
Real community safety measures, which does not mean more police within the neighborhoods, but actually means going through building real community bases of support that lean in the direction of violence prevention, but ultimately that can't be separated out from the real needs, you know, of housing, healthcare, education that working people face on the daily.
Following the California massacre, a congressman said that mass shootings are a uniquely American experience. With the termination of many coronavirus-era assistance programs and another recession on the horizon, few expect that such experiences will decrease. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Tens of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they call the school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. The first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's First Lady, Jamileh Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's Prime Minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence. About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies. Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences
regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to 7 of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.